Do you want to learn how to invest, or are you an entrepreneur and want to build companies in the regenerative food and agriculture space? Or do you work in big ag and big food and want to really move the needle? We have developed a new video course for you. Find out more on investinginregenerativeagriculture.com/course or in the show notes description below.
It seems so idyllic. Selling your apartment in London, quitting your well-paid jobs and buying 10 acres in Wales to farm. Back to the land, the good life, the simple life. Until you get punched in the face again, again, and again. Farming isn't easy, let alone profitably and ecologically sound on a small scale. Don't let anybody tell you differently. Today's story unpacks one of those examples which, after 7 years of regen farming, might go bankrupt this month. Learn all about duck eggs, feed prices, black soldier flies, vermicompost, back to the land, and if they make it through the winter, how they are planning to dramatically change their business and scale their impact. This is the Investing in Regenerative Agriculture and Food podcast, Investing as if the planet mattered, where we talk to the pioneers in the regenerative food and agriculture space to learn more on how to put our money to work to regenerate soil, people, local communities, and ecosystems while making an appropriate and fair return. Why my focus on soil and regeneration? Because so many of the pressing issues we face today have their roots in how we treat our land and our sea, grow our food, what we eat, wear and consume. And it's time that we as investors, big and small, and consumers start paying much more attention to the dirt / soil underneath our feet. To make it easy for fans to support our work, we launched our membership community, and so many of you have joined us as a member. Thank you. If our work created value for you, and if you have the means, and only if you have the means, consider joining us. Find out more on gumroad.com/investinginregenag. That is gumroad.com/investinginregenag. Or find the link below. Welcome to another episode. Today with Josh of Park Carrick. Welcome, Josh. We're going to talk a lot about the current emergency, but I also want to know a lot about duck eggs, geese eggs, and what brings you to start a farm in Wales. So welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Ken. It's really great to be here.
And let's start. I will put a beautiful video, which is sort of a bit outdated now, but still very, very pretty, in the show notes below if you want to see a visual overview of the farm you and your partner are running. But just to give a bit of an intro, because you didn't grow up in farming, what brought you to, literally, what brought you to the land and start a farm? And then we'll get into, we're recording this at the end of October 2022, we'll get into the current situation and what you're doing about it and why you are in an emergency.
Yeah, thanks, Kun. I'm actually South African, and Abby, my partner, she's British, and Before we moved to the land, we were living and working in London, and we were there for 8 years working in the city. I was working in tech, in mobile software actually, and I think after 8 years in London, we just got incredibly itchy. You know, like I started wanting to get outside. I'm from, as I mentioned, from Cape Town, South Africa, so I grew up in a very beautiful place. And
are you suggesting that London isn't very beautiful?
You know, it's a bit of a concrete jungle, and like, it was super exciting when I first got there, you know, the bright lights and everything. But after about 8 years there, I really started craving, you know, wanting to get out of the office, wanting to get outside. And just having
it's still a long time, like 8 years is a proper definitely the shiny lights were nice for that's a considerable amount of your career and your time.
Yeah, it was a slog, but it was hard work, but I did really enjoy it. I worked with some amazing people in London, but you know, it was something about being in a city with all those, you know, the constant noise, the sirens, the bright lights, the being in an office, an air-conditioned space with not much fresh air, and it just, I think I over the years, I got quite a lot of anxiety being in that environment. I wanted to get outside. I wanted to do something with my hands. I wanted to be more physically active. I felt unhealthy. I didn't feel like I ever had time to do any, you know, physical exercise or anything. So one day we just made this like really brash decision. We were like, do you know what? We're gonna sell our little flat in London. We're gonna quit our jobs and we're gonna go and start a farm. And it was like, we had no idea what we were about to get into.
And what do you remember? What triggered that? I mean, I know people have seen The Biggest Little Farm, but I don't think it was out there yet, or maybe it was, and said they were going to do it, but then the next day reality kicked in and they didn't sell their flat in London and they didn't quit their jobs and their lives basically, and you did. Was it like, was it a very rainy, I don't know, February, very cold, or was it something like, what was there a specific moment or what led up to it, and then what made you actually do it?
There were a few things. One was health issues. Like both of us were experiencing health problems, and I had gotten really far down the rabbit hole of diet and came to the conclusion that I needed to actually be more involved in my own food production in order to ensure that I was eating healthy, nutrient dense food. And actually, I see a lot of people with a similar motivation in this space. So that was one reason. The other reason was I had this constant impending sense of doom, like, you know, the world was about to come to an end. And I think a lot of that was just anxiety from living in the city. And I felt helpless. I felt helpless about, you know, the climate disaster that's coming. And I'm not someone who likes to, when I feel worried about something, I really want to get up and go and do something about it. Like I can't stand talking about stuff. And so, you know, agriculture is a huge issue that, and a contributor to climate change. And I really felt like I wanted to get out there and just have a go and just see if I could actively do something that might, you know, help make the world a better place one day. And then the last contributing factor to us actually getting up and going and doing it was I actually started working from home on the last project that I was doing. I left the company that I was working for and I started consulting and freelancing working from home. And that experience of working from home and having my own free time and space to think really just, I think it just tipped me over the edge into wanting to sort of detach myself from corporate life. And I think it's funny because a lot of people have gone through something similar in recent times with COVID when everyone was sort of forced to go back home and to start working from home.
So I think a lot of people reconsidering home, like, oh, actually, yeah. It's not just the place I sleep. I should probably do something. Yeah.
It was a very powerful experience. All my meals were home cooked. I was no longer going down to the local shop to go and get a sandwich to suddenly just scoff down in front of my computer whilst I was banging out an email. You know, I was actually like going and preparing a meal for lunch. And it was just.
And they're still eating it at your computer. Like, but yeah, that was a different.
Yeah, sometimes. Yeah. But it's a powerful process. And I think a lot of people have experienced the same thing and really reevaluated where they're at in their life. And a lot of people have made some pretty big decisions as a result of it. So, So that was the thing that one of the things that that tipped us over the edge. And Abby and I had always talked about having a farm one day. And the idea was we were going to go and, you know, do something in the city, get rich, retire, buy a farm and, you know, enjoy our lives. And we talked a lot about this and exactly. And I was sitting in a London bus one day and coming home from work and another bus sort of passed and there was this big ad on the bus. I can't remember what the brand was or who the ad was for, but it just had this line, start where you want to go. And I was like, why do we want to...
Advertisement doesn't have impact. That's, yeah.
Yeah, well, it had a huge impact on me, but unfortunately, I don't think it increased sales for them very much because I can't even remember what the brand was. But I thought about that statement, start where you want to go. And I was like, why do you want to wait until you are possibly 60 years old and retired? Probably not, you know, as fit and active as you are now. Why do you want to wait until then to start farming? If you really want to farm and you want to work outside and you want to enjoy that lifestyle, then enjoy it while you're young and while you're still physically capable of doing it. So I was like, okay, right. How do we actually do this? Like, could we actually sell our home and buy a farm? How would we make this happen? So it was, and from there, the process started basically.
And I mean, there's so much to unpack there and I want to get to the emergency, but just as a sidestep for a second, at that moment, did you make it deliberate or was it always part of the plan to farm, not just as a homestead for yourself? You were talking a lot about, of course, the challenge of getting access to or more involved in your own food, but there's a difference between your own food and food for others. Like, was that from the beginning, of, okay, we need this. It's not that I'm going to keep working maybe remotely or freelance for a day a week and with that. Mm-hmm. We keep things going, and the farm is mostly as a homestead for our own food. Or was it from the mm-hmm. beginning the plan to actually farm and live off the farm as well, in terms let's say economically?
Yeah, it's a good question. Actually, it started off with the idea of going off grid, and some of my colleagues, if they're listening to this, they'll remember I had this idea to actually create a space for digital nomads to go off and come and work on an off-grid farm. And that was going to be, it was mostly going to be about self-sufficiency, being off-grid, and providing a space for people to escape to.
But still connected to the fiber optic cable, yeah. That grid.
Connected to all the fiber and connected to my old digital, my digital addictions. And it did start off there. And then, of course, we got into permaculture hugely, and we got into self-sufficiency and that whole that whole area. But we very quickly, as things sort of unraveled and as we started pursuing it, we very quickly realized that, okay, we need to figure out how we're going to make a living doing this realistically, for long reasons. Or I won't get into this too much, but basically we were going to go to Spain because we thought that's the only place we could afford to buy land. And then Abby actually got diagnosed with MS, and it was a massive shock. It was literally as we left London, we had our camper van, we had all of our stuff in storage. We're on our journey about to go and find some land and go off to Spain. And then boom, Abby's legs started getting numb, and it was like, that's weird. What's going on? And long story short, we ended up in the hospital and we ended up with a diagnosis of MS. And we were just like, how are we going to go off to Spain and start this thing away from family, away from the NHS, when Abby's potentially got this like completely debilitating disease moving forward? So without going too much down that rabbit hole,
the camper never went on the ferry.
We decided, let's stay in the UK. Let's stay close to family. Let's try and figure out how to do this in the UK, although it is expensive.
I mean, close to family. You're from South Africa, but yeah, that's never going to be close to family.
Should I say, close to Abby's family? Yeah. So
Wales it became very different climate. Yeah.
And Wales it became. Yeah. So we weren't going to do the digital nomad thing in Spain, but then we're like, well, how are we going to make money doing this? Well, if you've got land, you can be farmers. Okay, cool. And also, we felt this immense responsibility as potentially future landowners, people who are sitting on agricultural land. We felt this immense responsibility to actually be more than just self-sufficient, but to be actual producers and food producers.
To feed the city, yeah.
And feed people, because, when you take this idea of self-sufficiency, you can't scale that up. It doesn't work. You can't give everybody a 10, 20 acre plot of land and tell them to be self-sufficient. It doesn't work. So, we felt
sorry if some dreams of listeners have been shattered now. No, I don't think anybody listening to this is in that mindset. But yeah, no, that's physically, geography, and probably mentally, not a good idea to do that with everyone.
Yeah, it doesn't work when you scale it up. And so that very quickly led us onto regenerative agriculture. So we went from sort of permaculture to regenerative agriculture. And
when you say we went from one to, well, what's our, like the, I wouldn't say the big differences, but what do you say, what in your mind is that step from permaculture to regen ag? Why is that a step, and why is it not the same thing?
Yeah, it's not the, I don't see it as the same thing because, you know, but I love the design principles in permaculture, and I think you can apply them to not just all forms of agriculture, but, you know, many aspects of life, actually. But when you go and look at the permaculture influences or content out there, it is generally much smaller scale, more focused on self-sufficiency, and it's not really focused on productive large-scale food production. So you know, things are very much, they're not in neat rows, they're not in an organized fashion, they're not designed necessarily for commercial production or efficiency. So I mean, you can translate it into that form, but most of the influences in the space are
not. So let's say the current examples we see mostly, I'm going to get emails about this for sure, are the smaller scale homesteading, not necessarily commercial scale. That doesn't mean it cannot be done, but we just haven't seen it yet. It hasn't formed in that way or expressed itself in that way, let's say. So you went to, we need to feed people, so we need a, yeah, we need to be farming. And then how did you land on, I mean, you landed on a number of acres probably because you could afford them. And then the journey into, and then I promise we'll get into the emergency, but also we're still back here. Yeah. How did you land in the current form, let's say, of the farm? And we're now at the end of October. What emergency are you in?
Well, without going into too much detail about why we chose Wales, we ended up in Wales and we were keen to start. You know, we were like, what's quite unique about what we did and possibly a bit stupid is we didn't go and do any, we didn't really go and do any courses. We did one very little permaculture course, which to be honest, it doesn't really apply to what we've actually ended up doing. But we didn't go and volunteer on any farms. We didn't go woofing. We didn't go and do any real workshops or education or courses or anything like that. We had read lots of books. We had watched all the YouTube videos. I mean, you could call us YouTube farmers.
There's a difference. And I've seen in my notes, because Josh sent some nice notes over, the steepest learning curve in the world. Like, I want to know about that.
Yeah. I mean, it was an immense learning curve. And so we just jumped straight in. We ended up in Wales. The first place we looked at happened to be great. I mean, it's not like it was a mistake purchase. It was a great purchase, but it was the first place we looked at and we bought it. We just said, okay, we're going to start. And we were actually going to try and get planning permission to build a home, an eco home on the land, which is very difficult to do because it's agricultural land. But we decided that we didn't want to get distracted with building a house. And so we found a derelict little cottage a few minutes up the road, and we were really lucky. So we bought that and we just started squatting in this old Welsh cottage that was very much in a state and needed a lot of work. And we
so you
got
didn't
to,
want
work
to be distracted kind of, with building a house, but you had to rebuild another one, basically.
Exactly. Yeah. But at least we had a roof over our heads. You know, we were out
Fair
of the
point.
Wind and the rain. And a lot of people start this journey in a caravan in a field. And actually,
yeah,
we
I mean,
did
you had
live
a camper,
in,
so yeah.
Yeah, we did live in a caravan on our field for 3 months. And that was interesting and quite exciting, but not something I wanted to do long term. But yeah, so we were squatting in this little cottage and we just got to work on the land and we're like, right. It was the most threatening thing, honestly, like to look at 10 acres of pasture and try and, okay, right, now let's build a diverse and profitable and ecologically sound regenerative farm. Go. It was like, you know, imagine a writer staring at a blank page with a writer's block. It was like, oh my God, how, what are we going to do? So yeah,
we, where do you start? Like, what's the first, like, not with a spreadsheet, but like, what's the,
lots of spreadsheets, but it was very much like we were, you know, everything was a guess. Everything was just based on ideas and no practical experience. So we had lots of spreadsheets. We had, where we actually practically started was on the project that we thought was going to take the longest. So we needed to start first, which was our perennial crops, so the blueberries. So the first thing we, once we had decided roughly what, how we were going to earn our income, we decided, right, let's first get the blueberries in the ground because we know they're going to take many years to actually become productive. And then let's take it from there and build around that, because we knew we wanted to do blueberries. They're a high value crop. We had acidic soil. We knew of a neighbor who was successfully growing them. So we thought, right, it's a good first step. Let's do that. So we started with the blueberries. Then we realized, oh my goodness, there's this problem of having too much grass, which we didn't even think about. The grass just grows.
It rains. Yeah. It rains and there's sun and it just goes. Yeah.
Yeah, we've got the best, some of the best grass growth in the world. The grass just grows and you think, okay, well, either I lose my productive land to scrub and I rewild it, or I mow it, or I get some animals. So we're like, right, well, we're going to do the sensible thing and get some sheep, which may or may not have been sensible. Actually, I love them and I'm, you know, I would never regret getting them, but we got our sheep next. And then
you became a long story short on YouTube. Yeah.
Yeah. we're watching all the YouTube videos. Actually, to be honest, I did start connecting with local, more conventional farmers quite early on. I really wanted to sort of bridge the gap between.
What did they think of you? Like typical back to the landers that are going to hit
the fence,
a gazillion times, burn themselves, touch the electric. Yeah. Like, yeah, but they still, you still wanted to connect with them.
Yeah. I basically just went and got really drunk with one of them, or a few of them, actually a bunch of them. And that was the best way to do it. Honestly,
this was before you had a child. Yeah.
Yeah, before I had a child, yeah. Abby still remembers the night I came home and it was
But
awful.
It's investment in like networking and it's your rite of passage on the local community.
Yeah. I think I connected with people, some of the local farmers really well like that, and you know, a lot of barriers were dropped and a lot of, you know, they could see what my intentions were and that I wasn't like completely off my rocker, because there's a huge cultural gap between rural folk and city folk. I mean, there's just such a huge divide there. And, you know, they looked at us and we were just a classic example of townies that had money and wanted to come and buy some land and live the good life. And yeah, as I said in one of my YouTube videos recently, which you watched, you know, I was told by several different farmers, there's a saying around here, they arrive in their fancy cars and they leave on their bicycles. And it's because they have seen it many times. And it's actually, I talk about the back to the land movement that we were very much a part of, the most recent wave, which I think it seems like quite a few people started on this journey around 2015-ish. It seems like around here, there was this big sudden surge of people moving into the area, trying to do this sort of alternative stuff. But there's been many of these waves before. And I've been told by a few locals that it happened, I think it happened back in the 60s and I think again in the 80s. I can't remember the exact dates, but it's happened on several occasions. And most of the time it ends in tears, in divorce, in debt and financial ruin. Honestly, I mean, it tears people apart because there's this ideal and there's this expectation of the good life and what it is and what it means, and then there's the reality of Mother Nature and farming and the and how tough it is. And
let's double click on that. I mean, not the divorce part, because that's not the case, but the depth part might be, shouldn't be the case, but we are in the toughness now. Where do you find yourself now? So you planted the blueberries, you have some sheep, but I don't think that's a huge part of, I think the flock is 20 or so, or maybe even less now. But the main part is duck eggs, which you figured out is an interesting market. But now you're being hit by input costs, by feed costs, which we in the regen movement always say, no, but the input cost doesn't really reach us too much. But of course, if you buy organic grains and it arrived from somewhere or Ukraine this year, you're going to be hit, even if you don't get it from Ukraine. Like, prices have gone through the roof. Any energy intensive sector is being hit right now. Even if you get your green electricity from somewhere, it's connected to the gas price and it explodes. So what situation do you find yourself now in? I will put the YouTube videos. You're documenting this story as it goes every week, which I highly recommend people to watch. I'll put it below. But where do you find yourself now? And then we'll unpack a lot of the back to the land movement and the potential future of that, because that wave is going to repeat itself. I'm not too worried about that, but the question is, what do we do with it and how do we make some impact on the land? But where do you find yourself now, and why are we recording now? Because this was going to happen, but it wasn't necessarily scheduled for the end of October 2022.
So I mean, to cut to the chase, our farm is about to go bankrupt, and we've pretty much just got November. Like, our cash flows tells us that you reach the end of November, and unless you figure something out, that's game over. And I decided to start a little series on YouTube called How to Fail at Farming. And I did that because I thought, right, if we're going to go under, if this is going to be it, I have to extract some value out of this failure. You know, I have to take something good away from it. And I want to help educate people about the realities of small-scale agriculture and agriculture in general and how tough it is. And I want to share our learnings with people. I want to share what I think we've done wrong, what we could have done better, how we're going to potentially get out of this. And I decided I'd like to document the process, because no matter what happens, I think that that will be of value to the community moving forward. The main thing that nailed us, or is nailing us, is the rising cost of feeds linked to Russia and Ukraine and the global.
And just to give us an idea, like what kind of percentages are you looking at now? Or what kind of money, like cash flow going out basically or every month, just to see how tight or how negative it got.
Our costs have increased by more than 50% since I installed our new feed bin, so our feed silo that we've got, which was last year. Early last year, we installed that feed bin so that we could benefit from bulk feed prices. You know, before then, I was buying bagged feed and I was hauling it by hand. And so our prices have gone up by more than 50% when you factor in all the other inflation across all of the other costs in our business. It's hard to, even though they should know, retailers, it's hard to get them to understand the speed at which you have to put your prices up. And I have now the supply, our main supply that we're with, our main customer that we're with now has agreed to a very steep price increase with us. And it remains to be seen what exactly, how that will impact the demand for our eggs. But luckily we've got some very, very good customers who really care. So I think we'll be supported in that way. But our business, you know, we have to, our feed bill every month is thousands. And for such a small business like us, that is massive. Now, people who've watched the YouTube series so far, we've done part one and part two, will know that we've just recently culled a large portion of of our flock, and that's to help reduce our feed bill. And I think that the other thing that I do want to make people, I really want to emphasize that although the feed bill has really been the nail in the coffin, I think that it's important that we take responsibility for the fact that there are other factors at play here, other reasons why we're in trouble. And, you know, a lot of that is due to the fact that we are inexperienced farmers, you know, that we spent the first sort of 5 years figuring out exactly what how this whole farming thing really works, yeah, and separating the, you know, myths from actual, you know, fact from fiction, that you, the fiction that you see on YouTube from the actual facts on the ground for people who are trying to earn a living full-time farming. And we also have certain ideals, you know, ideals about how we want to run the farm, how we want to keep our animals. And those ideals make it very difficult, make it more difficult to be profitable. And there is a reason why farmers do things the way they do. And we're learning the hard way. So, so that those are sort of some of the part of, those are some of the reasons as to why we're in the situation we're in. But the businesses, as I said, you know, it's crunch time for us. This is a cash flow issue for us, and it's happened very quickly. And I think the other thing to mention is that there's, you know, I've been contacted by quite a few people since releasing those videos saying, you know, they don't fully understand the mechanics of poultry businesses. Like, you know, they think, for example, that our ducks could potentially forage more land, or that potentially we're not managing our grassland properly in order to help feed the animals, or that we should be somehow growing our own food or feed for the poultry, for our ducks. And I think it's because regenerative agriculture is generally, there's a lot of the focus is on ruminants, on grazing animals. And with poultry, it's a whole different story, you know.
They need grain, or they need some nutrient
dense. They need nutrient dense food, yeah. They don't have that ability to turn grass into
except
nutrition.
For geese, right, if I understand correct.
Like, except for geese, yeah.
Would that be... Why did you go for ducks, not for geese? Because you talk in that video that I mentioned at the beginning. Like, they have this unique opportunity or unique capability, sorry, of actually foraging and still create high nutrient dense protein in shape of eggs and meat. What was geese even more difficult than ducks to find? Like, duck eggs, are geese eggs even more difficult to sell than duck eggs? Or is that a future, I wouldn't say thought or idea, like to find the one poultry species, in this case, geese, that actually can forage and doesn't need all of that, or maybe even none of it in terms of outside, very expensive at the moment feed?
Yeah, yeah. It's a really good question. And I've put so much thought into geese, and I really love the theory behind it.
What's the practice?
We've had geese. We actually recently got rid of our geese because over the years, we've just realized simplify, focus on what you're good at and what you're doing. And the geese were really creating some issues for us, specifically when we had to lock down the birds during avian flu. So we decided to simplify things there. But with geese, they're amazing. You know, they have that ability to turn grass into forage, to turn forage and grass into actual meat. You wouldn't really keep your geese for eggs. That's not, they don't, you know, they produce maybe 30 eggs a year compared to a Khaki Campbell that does roughly 300 eggs a year. You would really be keeping the geese for the meat. It's what we in the UK at least would have eaten for Christmas dinner, you know, much more commonly than say turkey. So it was really a traditional Christmas roast. The meat is delicious. There's lots of fat on it. It's much more moist than turkey is, although I know a lot of people say you just got to cook the turkey right, which I've never managed to do. But geese is absolutely delicious.
Has no methane.
There's no methane as far as I know, which I find really amazing because they don't really use, from what I understand, they don't use fermentation to actually digest the grass. It's their unique gizzard which actually does that breaking down, and they have to eat constantly. And there's actually quite a lot of waste. When it comes out, the grasses, you know, they have these really big green poos which look almost like unprocessed grass. But they manage to do it by just constantly eating.
Which is it good for the land? Like, is it a good grazer, quote unquote?
Yeah, they're very good lawnmowers. They are. They're very good lawnmowers.
Sorry, I was interrupting you. You were saying if we would, like, what is there a future place for geese on the farm if, like, a year from now we're talking to farmers?
Yeah, if we were going to get into geese, it would be for the meat. And you know, this is another example I take issue with minute scale agriculture, very small scale agriculture. And this is one of the reasons is because, you know, they talk a lot about diversity and stacking enterprises. And so geese was one of those examples which we were trying to add into the mix. But if we were going to process geese for meat, to do that effectively, it would be another capital investment that we'd have to make because we'd need that abattoir. We'd need to be able to process the birds.
You need a few thousand birds at least a year, probably more.
Yeah. You need enough birds to justify it. You know, you need the correct equipment. Processing geese is actually very difficult. Like processing chickens, easiest. Ducks is the next step up in terms of difficulty because of all their down and how hard it is to pluck. And then geese are even further up there. So they're very difficult to process. They're also very seasonal. People tend to only want them during Christmas or sort of around wintertime. They take quite long to grow and finish. And so you've got a large portion of the year where you're working on growing these geese and then a very small window of time to sell. And
so you
then
have to
also
like sort of sell all of them pre-sell.
So
a very different, it's not a business you can just easily stack on top and just make a bit of extra money left and right. No, you need to do this full time and
If I was doing a meat business with, say, some chickens or ducks already, and I already had the processing facility and the license and everything, sure. I think it would make a lot of sense to add geese into the mix, but as an egg producer, primarily as an egg producer, it's just a whole nother level of investment for us. So another loan, you know, and so coming back to the feed issue with ducks is that, you know, you can't rely on acreage to feed your ducks. You have to rely on ghost acreage. You know, you have to rely on arable grain producers to help you feed your ducks or your chickens or whatever poultry you might have. And, you know, people say, well, then you shouldn't have poultry or they're not. Well, on 10 acres, you can't keep ruminants and make a business. It's just not possible. You know, I would, in order to make a business
like a small scale dairy or something. I'm joking. But you're not going to make any money or very.
You could try. You're not going to make enough money, basically. And so when you've got 10 acres, you've got limited options. I mean, I basically put it down to two options. You've got poultry if you want to do livestock, or you've got market gardening. And the market gardening thing, I've tried both. I haven't tried market gardening at the same level of intensity as the ducks because that was our primary focus. We did a bit of market gardening alongside the poultry. But the problem is locally here, you know, there's not, there isn't that easy to access market to go and do a veg box scheme, really. We've already got some very well established market gardeners / wholesalers in the area who do a great job. We also have a lot of really small family run retailers who buy in from, you know, the local wholesaler. And you know, people have that community. They have that those little high streets and the place where they go and they buy their veg. And it's not like it's not like maybe a city where all of it's supermarket veg and you want to maybe come and disrupt things and you want to say, hey, don't go to the supermarket, come to me, buy the veg directly and buy a veg box. And, you know, I don't really want to go and say, hey, stop buying from your local family small retailer on the high street and come and buy
directly from us. No.
Yeah. So in our context,
that leaves poultry basically. Yeah.
So it leaves poultry if you really, and I should also clarify, because our goals from the start were, and this was a bit too idealistic really, and this is one of my lessons that I've learned, is our goals from the start was we were going to be 100% farmers on the farm, no side hustles, no other income. And that was our goal. And you know, I was warned by the other farmers, the real farmers.
10 acres. Yeah.
I was warned, Josh, you're not going to be able to do that. And being the type of person I am, I dug my heels in and I said, no, I'm going to show you that on 10 acres, I'm going to be a farmer producing nothing other than food and I'm going to make it work. And that was too idealistic. And so a lot of the time you see other people making small scale farming sort of work in, I'm doing, you know,
quote unquote, with Airbnb, tourism, courses, experiences, dinner, anything else than selling pure food.
A job on the side.
Like 90 plus, I'm getting the numbers wrong. Manning's going to kill me. But I think even in the US on large scale commercial farms, the majority, I'm going to say somewhere in 80, 90% has an off-farm job. For sure, also for medical reasons, for healthcare reasons and insurance reasons, other reasons, just to pure cash. But even there at that scale, most farmers or most farming families have an off-farm job to keep the lights on, which is very scary if you think about it.
It's very scary. And, you know, I mean, the real farmers around here, they not only do they have a job on the side, like HGV driving, which pays pretty well, actually, especially these days, or contracting, using the kit that they've got, the tractors and whatnot. But they also tend to have hundreds of acres and they are claiming subsidies on that acreage. So in our case, we were really screwed.
They're not even commercially farming, if you think about it. Yeah,
I mean, you know, they don't get me wrong, they're putting a lot of hours in and they're working hard. Yeah, something else I just want to say is, since arriving here, I have never met a people or a community of people that work as hard as farmers. I mean, they are hard.
We just put out an interview like this week of the laziest farmer of the UK.
And I listened to it with Matt. That's right.
Yeah, and it's interesting that whole definition of, I have to work until, like, I have to burn the midnight oil and in summer I have to be on my tractor until midnight. And it's very interesting. And it's probably a lot of that is needed, but also a lot of that is part of that.
Mm.
And he said, yeah, I'm too lazy to farm against nature. Like if the conventional extractive system is also extremely hour intensive and does not sustainably mentally, like you cannot do that forever. And hope that that's fine. And if you're not making, like if you did it for a few years and your farm is getting off the ground and the system is starting to work, etc. No, it's a slow hill. Like it's a downhill slowly or fastly. And I can only imagine the level of stress. I think the farmer suicide rates everywhere in the world are way, it's like one of the most dangerous jobs. And
it's the highest
accidents, suicides. It's crazy.
I believe farming is the highest suicide rate of any other industry, from what I understand.
You went there, like from the city, you wanted to be outside, work a lot, deal with your anxiety.
Yeah,
it's probably not the combination you want to bring to farming. Looking back,
I mean, I'll say that farmers, like multi-generation farmers, so not you know, not really first generation farmers like myself, but guys and girls who've been in this business for many generations and grown up with it, they are cut from a different cloth. I mean, they work hard and they work in rough conditions and for very little pay. And it never ceases to amaze me. And it's just incredible. But you know, our situation, as I was saying, not only were we trying to do it without a job on the side, or a non-agricultural related enterprise like Airbnb, which we now do have because we realized. But we were
cash
also
is cash.
we're also just, we don't even qualify for subsidies. You can't get any subsidies on 10 acres. You have to be slightly bigger. And even then, you know, basically the more acreage you have, the more farm subsidies you can claim. So it is a case of size helps a lot. So let's talk about November.
Yeah, let's talk about November. What needs to happen now to get you through the winter? And I want to hear your future vision. Mm-hmm. You're going to do a massive Airbnb experience with fiber optic cable and remote working or something else on the farming side. But what needs to happen now and what are you going to do to basically solve the cash flow issue and get you through the winter? And is that enough? Because are you like... Mm. expecting that feed costs will come down, or what happens after the winter?
Mm. First of all, we're definitely not going to do any more than one Airbnb, and I'll talk why.
It's also a lot of work.
When you work it out per hour, it pays a hell of a lot better than farming. But I'm still have ideals about being primarily a food producer, and I don't want to turn it into a big campsite. You know, I think it's great having one Airbnb there. People need to be able to come visit the farm. It's a good extra bit of income, but I definitely don't want to turn it into a big campsite. Where we are now is, as I said, end of November, if we don't generate around about £5,000 is the minimum that we need to see us through the winter. And so the plan is actually to run a crowdfunding campaign to help generate that cash. Actually, when I started the YouTube channel, that wasn't our intention. You know, that we only did it because, first of all, my best friend from South Africa rang me up and he was like, "Josh, man, you can't. You've been doing this for 7 years. You can't just let this whole thing fall apart. You need to do a crowdfunder." And he said that, and then I started getting a load of comments on the video, like, "I would support you. I would do a GoFundMe, whatever." And we were very reluctant because
your idea of making it work. Yeah.
Yeah.
By yourself.
We see that even more as failure. And, you know, we see ourselves as a commercial business, not a charity. But so we've actually, we've come up with an idea for, we're going to do a crowdfunder, but there will be rewards that people get back and there'll be very real things that they can get in return. So we're not just going to take donations.
You're going to ship eggs to South Africa. No.
No, I happen to know from experience they ship very badly.
I can only imagine the mess. Yeah.
Yeah. So
it's going to be a crowdfunding with rewards and for about 5K, which sounds possible. I mean, it depends on your crowd, obviously. And let's hope some of the crowd is listening to this because that would be already, let's say, for the space to see the transition, to make sure you make it. And then enable you to go through a transition would be very interesting. Not that next year you'll be in the same issue and have to keep out. That I think is your reluctance, is like not wanting to keep asking the crowd to keep going and thus not being financially stable.
No. So one thing, you know, we've had to think very hard about this because one thing we do not want to do is we do not want to just limp along. We don't want to take, you know, £5,000 and then sort of get to next year.
No, use this emergency to get to the next level, or to go down or get to the next level. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We need to fail fast or we need to, and just
no depth,
you know, change our lives and do something else. Or we need to actually figure out how are we going to sustainably move this forward on 10 acres.
You can sell the farm to the next, back to the land movement. That's probably happening like every 7 years. I mean, if they study this, they've already seen it's like some kind of cycle.
There are plenty of people out there who want to have a go just like we did. And I would just tell them, go for it, but just don't quit your day job, basically. You know, we've actually got some very interesting opportunities on the horizon. We've got, for confidentiality reasons, without talking about it in great detail, there is a farm in Europe that wants to buy hatching eggs from us. And that being fertilized duck eggs, which they can then incubate, and then they can basically get our genetics of khaki Campbells onto their farm.
And then suddenly your 10 acres, let's say, multiplies. The whole seed thing is very interesting. We're going to do another episode on that, and the nutrient
seeds,
density.
Yeah.
And the genetics and selling to others your... It's an input, but it's not really an input. Like then suddenly with 10 acres, you can... I'm imagining, yeah. I don't know how that works in duck eggs, but you can, let's say, touch a lot more hectares and acres and touch a lot more people.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, hatching eggs are incredibly more valuable than table eggs, like immensely so. So that would...
What is immensely? 10x, 50x, 100x?
Like, you know, you're talking sort of 40 pence an egg, table eggs, compared to, which is, we are very, by the way, anyone listening should know, we are not failing because we're not niche enough and we're not premium enough, okay? We are the UK's only organic duck egg producer. And
talking about a niche,
and we sell our eggs. I imagine our eggs are probably the most expensive in the UK. So that's not why we're failing. Yeah. Our eggs are about 40 pence each. And you know, hatching egg, depending on the volumes you're selling it, but at small volumes, you're selling it at £2.50 an egg. You know, so it's many times greater, and it makes a huge difference to our business. So.
And is that easy to do? Probably not. Otherwise, they wouldn't be searching for you. They would be trying to find somebody on the continent.
It's not hard to do. You know, you ultimately just have to set up a breeding group, and you have to. But the thing is, you need the right genetics, and so
which is not easy.
When it comes to Khaki Campbells and the ducks that we keep,
which is a type of ducks, just for people to.
It's
a specific genetics. Yeah.
We keep Campbell breeds all focused on egg laying, and the three breeds we've got are dark Campbells, Khaki Campbells, and Welsh Harlequins, which are also actually Campbells.
And you've been selecting that for years, obviously, on quality, like on laying, on easiness,
exactly.
And disease. I mean, you've been selecting and now maybe in a position to start selling. Yeah.
Exactly. So those duck breeds are pretty rare. First of all, just the fact that there are very few duck egg producers in the UK, let alone actually organic certified duck egg producers. So you don't get many farms who have that sort of volume, those population numbers like we do to select from. You know, you've got lots of backyard people with ducks, but they've got small populations, and those populations are coming from other places which are not breeding in the same way that we're breeding. So I look at our breeding program as a regenerative breeding program, which the way we go about it is you know, we are breeding for every generation to be better than the previous one, and we're doing that by brutally selecting out birds that don't meet our requirements. We're withholding as much we're mollycoddling and care, and you know, we're giving them a natural environment, and we're saying we're not going to give you all the additional medication and parasite wormers, and we're not going to basically
see who makes it. We're gonna the toughies, yeah.
Yeah, it's survival of the fittest, and we're not going to try and optimize your performance through inputs. You know, if there's an animal welfare issue. And we do the same process with our sheep, and I'm really stoked about where we've got to with our flock of sheep. But if there's an animal welfare issue, we immediately treat them, we sort them out, we make sure they're happy, but they get a black mark and they do not move into the next flock. And our criteria that we have when selecting are much stricter than what people usually have. Like, for example, with our sheep, if a sheep gives birth and we have to pull that lamb, we're not happy because we got a big lamb. We're really annoyed because we had to pull the lamb. We want sheep that, and that is very common amongst farming community, is, you know, they're proud about how many lambs they've pulled and how big the lamb was when it came out.
So how unique is that approach, like that genetic approach also in sheep? Because I sense that there's another opportunity there as well, like to get these genetics right on low input also in terms of time and resources, and having to pull sheep or having to medicate ducks, which for sure is not easy. Like, how unique is that approach to creating the toughies?
I think it's quite unique, actually. Like, even if people say that they, you know, everyone says that they're selecting the best of the flock for the next
generation. Case, best means something else. Yeah.
But in this case, it's like okay, you're saying you selected the best, but you know, how much attention, how much like resources did you give that flock through the year? Like, how many inputs and resources did you get that animal to look like that and perform like that? And so we've been from the very beginning giving, we call it minimal intervention, and that is we give them as little as possible and we see how they do, and if there's an issue we treat it, and then they don't get bred from. And we have lots of criteria that we score them against, and then from, and then we select them for breeding. So regenerative,
Mark Shepherd calls it, like, what is it, stun, shear,
yeah, shear total, no, out of neglect, that's right, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Now, I don't neglect, maybe is a bit tricky, but yeah, you get the idea.
Yeah. I don't utterly neglect them. You know, and he uses that principle with plants, right? And we've actually done the same thing with our blueberry patch, which is a whole nother story. Regenerative breeding. So our genetics, we also happen to get our Khaki Campbells came from a farm, they're called, a family called the Cortlangs. And they have a farm, and I don't know exactly how many generations. Someone said to me they've been breeding Khaki Campbells for 7 generations, and I'm not sure if that number is.
But the family, yeah.
The family have been breeding Khaki Campbell ducks.
So how many generations of ducks? That's
generations. Oh, many. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I say 7. You know. People don't
could
quote
be six,
me on
could
this
be
because
five,
it could be less, but they've been doing it pretty much the longest of anyone, and they're actually known all around the world for their genetics. Now, that's where our original Khaki Campbell genetics came from. And then in 2020, when COVID kicked off, very last minute, I found out that Peter Cortlang, who was the last, you know, member of that family, the last member who still wanted to farm, he decided to retire, and no one else wanted to take over the family business. So he sold it on to someone else. That other person seems to not be doing a hell of a lot with the flock that he got. And we were like, well, we're sitting on 200 ducks right now that came from Peter. And we need to breed our own. We're going to start breeding our own ducks. So we got into that. So the genetics that we've got are really special.
Did you make
special.
An attempt to buy the other one or not?
Did we make an attempt?
Before Peter retired?
No. By the time we heard from Peter, he had already found a buyer and sold all of his incubators and everything. So,
but it made you aware, like, okay, we need to, there's not going to be a place anymore to buy our future flock, so we need to do it ourselves.
Yeah, and certainly not the quality that we were expecting. So,
yeah, of course.
So we had a really good stock to begin with, and we built up from there, and then we've applied our regenerative breeding principles to that. And so we've got these, so coming right back to your original question, sort of, and what's, how are we going to get through the winter and what's next? So, one of the potential options for us in the future is to really sell our genetics and to take the role, you know, to the role of a leading breeder in that space for Khaki Campbell ducks. And this farm in Europe wants hatching eggs from us. And the very unique thing is they want quite a lot of hatching eggs from us. And it'll be a long period of supplying them hatching eggs. Because they want to build up their flock. They want to build up a flock of Khaki Campbells, and they don't have access to them. So that's one opportunity on the horizon, but it's not guaranteed. It's sitting there to kick off in March, but it's not 100%.
A lot of things can happen until March, yeah.
Yeah, and we are very close. We've been through a long process of getting an export license with DEFRA, and as far as I know, they are crossing I's and dotting the T's, dotting the I's and crossing the T's. And we should have our export license pretty soon to do that. So so that's an opportunity on the horizon. And then there are other aspects to. So there's another opportunity there, which is obviously the Airbnb will kick off next year because it'll be season again. And we were just too late with that this year. So our Airbnb was only ready at the end of the season. So the Airbnb will help next year. But the next really big opportunity for us, and what I'm very excited about, is essentially to produce a super compost from our duck manure. And so we have these aspirations for the farm moving forward. If we can get through the winter, if we can get over this hump and we can survive, where we want to ultimately take the business on our 10 acres, we need to be profitable, and we need to be comfortably, we need to be more resilient. And we just, you know, we are suffering right now with the feed price increase because we're just not resilient enough. And we admit that. And so moving forward, we need to be more profitable and more resilient. And we have this vision for two things apart from the genetics. One is to produce a carbon negative duck egg. And I've got a lot of work to actually, I want it to be calculated, and I want it to be calculated properly. You know, I don't want to greenwash this. I want this to be a proper sum. Maybe we can only get to carbon neutral, and that'll be fine too. But if we could get to carbon negative, I'd be very happy. So we want to produce a carbon negative duck egg.
Most of that work is going to be on the ghost acreage, basically on the grain side, or what where do you see the work that needs to be done? Because it sounds like on the farm itself, at least on the grazing of the ducks, which obviously don't graze a lot, like that, there's a limit there that you reached or will reach pretty quickly, even though all the YouTube commenters are saying you should grow your own feed, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. How are you going to get to a carbon positive or neutral or negative, whatever the right direction is? Let's say you get the picture. How do you get to that kind of
age? So it's a very good question. When we rely on so many ghost takers, how are we going to get to carbon negative or neutral? And the way I see us doing that is, first of all, we need to get off the soy as quick as possible. And that is the big sticking point for all poultry producers, is how do you get off the soy train? So we want to move over to black soldier fly larvae production. And I've talked about this in
my different YouTube community. Yeah.
Yeah, so there are technologies coming out. You know, a lot of people are like, oh, why don't you just do black soldier flies in your polytunnel? Or like,
don't worry, everybody that says that, I've seen the first factories from the inside. We've done due diligence at a fund I used to work with.
Yeah,
and it's fascinating, very possible, but not easy at all. Talking about genetics of flies, good luck.
Yeah,
is something you need to do at a. Yeah, this is not something you can do on the side in a room you have left over in
Exactly. And the other thing is, you know, black soldier fly larvae are native to the UK, so they don't survive through the winters here. Although climate change might change that.
Yeah. But and then that's always the point everybody raises. Don't worry if they escape. I've seen rooms full of these flies. Don't worry if they escape. They anyway die in the winter. Yeah, well, if the winters get warmer, we might get into other licensing issues. Yeah,
yeah. So it doesn't come without its complications.
But how much would that fix? How much would that help you? Because they are able to, and some other insects, but this specifically, to turn low-grade food waste, brewery waste, or any kind of sludge, basically, into protein. Into insects. And I've seen living examples, like living insects feeding them to poultry is very interesting for the poultry because it triggers something compared to pellets they get or compared to grain. But how much would that be, like the protein thing, would that fix a lot of your issues? Or would it just fit a small percentage of feed issue and you still have to buy 80% somewhere else?
It's it only fixes part of it only gets us part of the way to a carbon neutral or negative egg. But it is a huge part of that. I mean, I don't know in percentage terms, and I haven't got the exact numbers, but I know that our biggest impact by far is in the soy that we consume as a farm. So moving the poultry over to black soldier flies by taking local food waste and then converting that into insects and then feeding that to the ducks, you know, you're hitting on multiple things there. First of all, you're helping redirect food waste away from landfill, and that creates a lot of methane production, and that's pretty bad in itself. And then you're turning it into protein, and then you're foregoing your soya consumption, which comes from another part of the world and potentially is involved in deforestation, etc. So there's a massive improvement there by switching over to black soldier flies.
Does it do anything for the taste and nutrient density of the eggs?
Oh yeah. I mean, on that point of view, that's the other thing is, like, we really
want to be carbon negative and the most healthy egg in the world. That would be
yeah,
a nice
the most nutrient dense egg, because, by the way, duck eggs are a lot more nutritious than chicken eggs, and I'm a big fan of duck eggs in general. So we could potentially move towards being one of the most nutritious and nutrient dense eggs in the world as well.
Okay. But I'm imagining this is like a massive undertaking. Like, does it make sense on 10 acres?
Yeah, so I've actually had a conversation with a gentleman from a different company that do black soldier fly larvae. Like, a lot of people have seen in my videos, I referenced Better Origin, and I don't know what's the other one called now.
Anyway, yeah, the container size. You buy your off, plug and play, and it should work. Yeah.
They won't talk to me. I'm too small scale. And it wouldn't be realistic. But this other guy that I've spoken with, we had a chat, and it sounds like if I could get the flock up to 1,000 ducks, we've been sitting at 500. If I could get the flock up to 1,000 ducks, it would make commercial sense. I would match the current cost of feed by renting his shipping container, because that has a monthly cost that goes out, and then I source
local food. And he manages the shipping container.
No, I manage it. Okay. It's on the farm. I source local food waste. I blend that food waste. I feed it into this container in a tube, and the soldier flies eat that. And then I feed the flies to the, the larvae to the ducks.
Which fixes a huge issue for processing these, because that's a massive.
Alive.
Say a warning. It sounds really nice on YouTube videos, but it's the blending it, getting the right feed mix, I think, as always, like garbage in, garbage out. And but it's fascinating to, okay, so you need to make any commercial sense, it needs to be double the flock, and then you can do a big you get a lot of fertilizer out of it as well. That's the big thing with soldier flies, actually. It's not necessarily the protein, it's what they shit, basically, which makes it potentially even more interesting from a cash flow perspective.
Yeah, so I just want to say this is a pretty, this is a big idea, and to make this happen is not going to be easy, but it is the future of poultry and possibly pig production. It's going there. Like, I can see that as far as I can see, there are no other real better options. I mean, people will talk about, why don't you feed the ducks sort of legumes or beans or other sort of high protein grains. And, we've looked into it. People have tried it. There's all sorts of complexities around the anti-nutrients that come with those beans. And the conclusion overall has been soya is the ultimate protein for poultry, and that's why we use it for very good reason. But this really is going to be the future, and it's very early days, but that's where the world is moving. And if we carry on, I want to be on that train as soon as possible, because we need to
super get off the interesting
soil. Now the other part,
there's another piece
and then the other piece is so we'll have to source some carbohydrate locally. And that's going to be possibly wheat or barley. Now, there's going to be some sort of carbon cost to that, but we can't really do much about that. So that wheat or barley that comes in is it's got to be sourced locally, and it's just something we can't get around. The other side to the business is, as well as using the black soldier fly as the insect production, is I want to combine the poultry with short rotation coppice on the farm. So I want to reduce my grazing pasture. I want to reduce my pasture, my strict pasture only. I'd still have ruminants on there, but in very specific parts of the farm. But primarily, I want to grow large blocks of short rotation coppice that produces biomass that we can then cut, chip, and then include in the bedding for the ducks, which eventually becomes the compost that we produce. And the ducks will also be rotated around that coppice. And we're talking about a very densely stocked coppice of very fast growing biomass, like willow, poplar. In our case, gray alder grows incredibly well on our fields. So we would rotate the birds amongst that. They obviously do their thing and fertilize the ground underneath there. That helps with the biomass. You know, so any there's no waste there. You know, anything you're feeding the ducks, that ultimately gets pooped down beneath the trees. The trees use that. They grow. The trees provide the shade and the shelter for the poultry. We have a rotation of cutting that biomass. We chip it up and we include it into our bedding and then ultimately the compost that we produce. Now, the compost that we produce is going to be, we've been experimenting a lot with vermicompost and with farming worms specifically. So
we come back to insects.
We come back to insects again. And actually, the reason why we started experimenting with worms was because I thought originally, I can produce worms to feed to the ducks as their protein. But no, big no, because A, there's a very small loop there. There's a very small cycle between the duck manure, which the worms feed on, and then the ducks feeding on the worms. That loop is too small and frowned upon generally. So that for that reason, it's no good. But also the practicalities of producing the quantity of worms in a consistent supply to feed to the ducks, logistically, it's just not doable. So what I realized was, no, the worms are, we want to keep the worms as little workers on the farm who basically take the manure and the waste from the ducks and turn it into a super compost, basically. And there's a lot of established science on the benefits of vermicompost and the differences between aerated compost and actual vermicompost. So vermicompost is much more nutrient dense and it's much richer and it's much stronger. So there are a lot of benefits to vermicompost and there's just a lot of benefits to raising worms.
Like, is that like
it's niche?
You've done that before with duck eggs. I'm not so scared about that, but is there maybe a benefit from like the current input prices that there's more, people are more searching for the non-heavy fossil fuel chemical fertilizer because it went, whatever percentage up it went in your local co-op where you have to buy it. I'm imagining a lot of alternative, quote-unquote alternative input companies are getting a lot of calls this year. Do you see that as well? Like, okay, we have this political situation which is pushing our input prices up, but actually we might use it as a stepping stone to a system where we're going to produce a lot of inputs for other people that don't have this huge political and environmental cost to it.
Exactly. So when all of this stuff kicked off, I was like, well, it's negatively impacting the feed price, but actually fertilizer prices are skyrocketing. You see now every farmer around here, they were just spreading their muck like crazy. They were using every last scrap of muck they had. And all of a sudden, the local growers who usually, you know, get muck for free.
What is muck?
Sorry. Muck being manure, animal manure, farmyard manure. And, you know, usually the local growers and stuff are pretty much getting the stuff free as a waste product from farmers. And now they can't get hold of any because everybody's making use of every last drop of manure that they've got or crumb. Our duck manure becomes a lot more valuable. And the interesting thing about ducks is their manure is very rich. It's like chicken manure. Everyone knows that chicken manure is the most potent of all animal manures, but ducks manure is equally as potent, but it actually has much less ammonia in it. And ammonia is what burns plants. So you have to be careful with chicken manure because you can quite easily burn your plants if you apply it too much. And with duck manure, it's much more gentle, but it's still potent. And ducks produce a lot of waste. I read there was a study that had been done, which I read, and I how true this is, I don't know, but apparently, according to them, ducks actually produce more manure per kilo of body weight than any other livestock, or any other farmed livestock, should I say. So ducks produce a lot of manure. It's good quality manure. And because
which is an issue if you're living off duck eggs, but is an opportunity if you're selling manure. Yeah.
Yeah. And on top of that, we're using a lot of bedding in the house. Okay. We used to use straw. We now use this this like wood chip sawdust stuff that we get from a biomass boiler pellet manufacturer, and they have a byproduct that comes out of that process, which is like a dust that they can't actually use. So we actually use that now in our house for bedding, but we apply a lot of bedding, more bedding than you would normally do with other livestock, because ducks are ground nesting birds and you can't get them to lay in a raised up nest box. So in order to reduce the labor on the washing side, because you really do have to
layer,
wash duck
layer,
eggs,
layer, and layer. Yeah.
You just throw as much bedding as you can at it, because then your eggs come out cleaner. So as a result, we've got a lot of manure, a lot of carbon in bedding, and a lot of nitrogen.
So you're feeding that through the worms, and then it's ready to sell.
Feeding it through the worms, and it's been shown that when that material moves through a worm's gut, it comes out the other end at a perfect pH. It's neutral, spot on. And they also kill a lot of the pathogens and bad bacteria. And at the same time, they inoculate those castings. What comes out the other end is actually like...
Love the fact that it's called castings. Yeah, I remember from
it's called castings. Yeah. The probiotics that come out, the beneficial bacteria that come out of the worm's gut the other end, didn't exist, you know, before it went in the other side. So
selling that already or not? Like as the fertilizer piece, or that's one of the pieces to get started.
Yeah, I've produced some on the farm, and I've tested it with some of our stuff that we were growing in the polytunnel, and I was just amazed by how good it was. I mean, I used some stuff that I produced. I grew winter squash in it 1 year. And winter squash is a very hungry crop. You know, you produce these really big fruits. And then the next year, I took some of that beautiful black gold that we had produced and had already produced the squash. And I went and I grew tomatoes in it, which is another very hungry crop.
Which is another light item, yeah.
And next to the tomatoes, I had some locally produced organic certified compost that is generally well considered. And I put some tomatoes in that compost and some of the tomatoes in my compost, which was a year old already. And I left it in the polytunnel and ended up being too busy to manage the plants, you know, dealing
as
with all that stuff on
farmer.
The farm.
Yeah.
And I actually, in the beginning, I was like, oh, there's no difference. They're both growing the same. Okay, so nothing
which already
special.
Would be an interesting thing.
Yeah,
because
which already I was like,
Yeah,
I was like, at least, you know, we're matching, at least matching this compost. And then I just totally left the tomatoes because I was like crazy busy. And I came back later on, the polytunnel's all like overgrown and crazy and it's just been neglected. And there are these tomatoes, and the ones that are sitting in our vermicompost, still lush and green. And the ones that are sitting in the local compost that we got were all yellowing and dying. And clearly they were root bound, and I took the plants out of the pots and I looked, and you know, the roots were curling around and they'd been sitting in those pots way too long and they hadn't been watered. And I was just like, wow, okay. So even despite the fact, so somehow this vermicompost is really just giving it a lot of steam and helping it get through despite the neglect that it received. So
it's done. Yeah.
I was really convinced when I saw that. And I was like, wow, imagine when we start selling fresh vermicompost that hasn't been grown in for a year already. And so that's the product that we want to produce. You know, it's a product that you apply in much smaller volumes. And generally vermicompost is worth roughly 10 times the price. If you go and look at prices of compost online, you'll see standard compost versus vermicompost pretty consistently, the vermicompost is 10 times the value per liter is what they sell it in to regular compost. So when I look at the economics of a duck, or duckonomics, you know, there's
the
two
genetics and the output. Yeah, it's not the egg.
There's the genetics.
It's
yeah,
not
but
the,
actually,
the table egg. Yeah.
Yeah, there's two primary outputs. It's an egg and it's some poop. And it's kind of ironic that the situation we're in is that actually, do you know what, that egg, unless it's the genetics and the breed and the fertile egg, that egg as a table egg is worth much less than the poop that comes out the other side. So,
and how did the Black Soldierfly fertilizer come into that? Like, are you going to mix that through as well? Or that's just a separate piece and let's see.
Do you know what? I don't know yet. I mean, what happens when you mix that with vermicompost? I mean, you're talking about some serious rocket fuel. Maybe it's better to sell it as its own product. But you know, I think that if we're talking realistically, the compost business is much closer in terms of feasibility. The Black Soldierflies are a bit further out because we have to scale up to 1,000 ducks to make that work as a minimum.
And you have to manage that facility and get all the the issues out. I mean, that's going to take a few generations of like soldier flies before you get that to an optimum. Plus, you have to haul stuff onto the farm first, which is not easy. Yeah. And the mixing and blending. Yeah, no, that's of course.
We have a lot of capex to not, I say a lot, you know, in the greater scheme of things, it's not that much money, but we need to get a few things set up on the farm in order to scale the ducks up to 1,000 and to get one of these shipping containers set up. So that's further out in the future. What's closer in the future is the short rotation coppice, the biomass production, the compost and the vermicomposting. That can happen. You know, I'm already producing vermicompost now in preparation for spring next year. So that's kind of where we want the farm to go. But, you know, cash is king. Cash flow is super important. And it doesn't really matter what kind of dream you have for the future. If you can't sort the cash flow out, then you can't get there. And, you know, I love the saying, as Mike Tyson once said, everybody's got a plan until they get punched in the face. And we've just been punched in the face multiple times, many, many times over the last 7 years. And I feel like we're starting to learn. We're starting to learn how to duck and weave a little bit, the punches, but,
pun intended. Yeah.
Yeah. We've, yeah. So that's the idea behind the crowdfunding campaign. If we can get through the winter, then hopefully we can level Park Carrig up and make ourselves more resilient and adapt to this future that we all face.
I think it's a gazillion other questions I want to ask, and there's a whole other chapter I want to go into in terms of your vision for small, but most importantly, large scale agriculture and a regenerative future. But I also want to be conscious of your time. And I would think we'll leave it at that. This is the emerging or the current moment, the end of October 2022 is now. And hopefully we'll see you through the winter. Like you'll go through the winter, you'll make it. And then we can sit and explore. First of all, we're going to talk a lot about compost at the time for sure. And because you would have learned a lot and you would have sold for sure already, and you would be way further down the line with Black Soldier flies or other flies. But also to hear your vision and what you've learned in this. Everything needs to be small scale, but actually the future might be larger. And what your vision is there, that would be, I think, a part two. So I want to leave it at that. And you probably have some final words to share.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, just the last point to say is on the YouTube channel, you know, like if there are people out there listening
follow them.
If there are people out there listening to this thinking, well, I had plans to do this sort of really small scale, hyper diversified, lean, agile farm. And that was, you know, I think if there are people out there that want to do that, I want to encourage them to follow us on YouTube and watch this process unfold. because we had all the same ideas and we've read the same books as you and we've watched the same influencers on YouTube as you.
And then you got punched in the face. Yeah.
We got punched in the face multiple times. And, you know, we've done the diversification, the stacking the enterprises, we've done the niche products, the premium products, we've done the no dig, we've done the agroforestry stuff. It's not like we haven't tried the stuff. And I think that there's a lot of problems with this idea of small-scale agriculture being the future. My belief is that we need large-scale regenerative agriculture, and that is really the future and what is going to get us out of this mess that we face. So before you go and spend your money on a little parcel of land and start trying to change the world like we did, just take care and perhaps, you know, watch how things unfold for us, because it's very tough. I think it's important to say that there are influencers out there that have a very different context. On the surface, it looks like they're making it work, but there's a lot of other things at play. So your specific context is always really important. But that's all I'll say. And please do follow us on YouTube. And no matter what happens, you know, whether we make it or not, I think I'd like to share our journey with people. So thanks for having me on.
And thank you for that, because it's been refreshing, extremely needed, and very interesting to see, obviously, unfolding. And we'll be rooting. And of course, whenever the crowdfunding will go live, we'll put it in the description below as well. But definitely follow the YouTube channel and the social media channels of Josh to see how this story unfolds over the next month, because that's what we're talking about. This is not it hopefully will be a long-term story, but this is at the moment a short-term story.
Fingers crossed. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Ken.
Thank you so much for listening all the way to the end. For the show notes and links we discussed in this episode, check out our website, investinginregenerativeagriculture.com/posts. If you like this episode, why not share it with a friend or give us a rating on Apple Podcasts? That really helps. Thanks again, and see you next time.